So here we are,
almost at the end of the year, the calendar year that we have inherited from Western civilization, the Romans in particular in this case. And we are looking ahead at what life is bringing to us. We look back to learn from the lessons of the past. We look ahead to envision how we may put those lessons into practice and where, based on God's promises, we can take our actions to be where He expects us to be, where He prepared a place for us to be. When Christ started His teaching, He had, after 30 years of preparation, quiet rabbi suddenly burst into the scene after the temptation that we read in Matthew chapter 4. And he burst into the scene by doing public teaching, not just teaching in the synagogue, but in the public arena. And then the miracles that served anyone who was around noticed that this was a different rabbi. And that was necessary to start things moving fast, because after 30 years of preparation, he knew he had only 3.5 years to proceed and accomplish the mission. One of the things he needed to do is get enough attention to get enough people around him so that he could do something which was not common in his time, which was for he, as a rabbi, to choose his disciples. As he told them later, "You didn't choose me, I chose you." The common practice was that students would vie for a rabbi and go through the process of trying to convince this rabbi that they were worthy students for his teaching. He didn't do it that way at all. He picked the low echelon of people who hadn't passed the school, who hadn't passed the tests. And so we come to chapter 5, and he starts a foundational teaching, which I started on what I hope to be a series I can finish at some point in time. And seeing the multitudes, chapter 5, verse 1, he went up on a mountain, and we're not talking something like Mount Diablo. There are no such mountains around the area where he was, but a high enough place where he could sit and be on a mound and have his voice heard. It wasn't a mountain literally, more like a hill. There's been a debate as to which specific hill it might have been in. And he starts his teaching. He says, "And when he was seated, his disciples came to him." So from the beginning of his preaching in chapter 4 to this moment, not a whole lot of time went by. And from those initial crowds that got their attention shaken by the miracles, he now picks some individuals. They come closer to him, and then he opened his mouth and taught them. But of course, the crowd that surrounded him also could hear it. Taught them, saying, verse 3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We dealt with that on a message previously. "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." I don't know about you, when we had that giant tsunami that hit the Indian Ocean several years back, I remember being in anguish and not being able to control it and getting down with my face on the floor and weeping and asking God, "Now, I don't know these people from anywhere, but these are people that you created to worship you at some point in time, and they just drowned like rats, 350,000 of them." I said, "I know the plan, but you are their father. You know these people. How can you stand it?" That was my question. How can you stand it? There is one of the types of mourning that comes by. We mourn at the decadence that is overcoming this world more and more, and all the curses that come from behaviors that are instilled and resulting from wrong concepts, from basically believing the lie, and all the associated lies that have come from that tree. To me, foundationally, the idea of evolution. But ultimately, Christ is addressing a specific kind of mourning here. He's talking to his disciples from his perspective, what he was, who he was, in a civilization that was decaying. Maybe not as rapidly as ours, but it was decaying. And the mourning that he wanted them to confront was the mourning that comes from self-examination. When you realize you are at odds with the instructions that the King and Creator of the universe has given you, and you're off track. And if you remain off track, there's only one end for your life. Blessed are those who mourn. In personal reflection, we mourn when we compare ourselves to Jesus Christ. He says, follow me. It's a command. Peter says he left us an example that we should follow in his footsteps. That's basically what we are supposed to do. So when we compare ourselves to him, we mourn. We mourn because we see how far we are from the example that is set before us. We mourn when we compare ourselves to the law, the specific instructions that, when obeyed, tell God that we in fact love him, and we find ourselves short in loving God. We mourn when we come to that point of recognizing our situation and we bend down into repentance and understand that our behaviors and the behaviors of this world that deviate from God's law break his heart. And we want to be made aware of these things in such a way that hopefully our hearts are broken just like his is broken when he sees certain things in us, when he sees certain things in the world. And we mourn for those situations because we understand to some degree, limited as it may be, how much people are suffering by living in that particular way, by living in a lifestyle guided by lies that cause all sorts of issues and problems and misery and pain in their lives. Now, he does promise, blessed are those who mourn, because after we do that, we go back to the rest of the world. As we start working on abiding by the instructions of God and living life in that way and following in the footsteps of our Messiah, we then start progressing to a point where we see even more what's going on out there in the world and the suffering that is going on out there, because people simply either refuse to accept this book for what it is or fight and buck what they do understand, wanting to do whatever they want to do. And so we mourn for that more and more, and that's one of the reasons that can lead us to pray very earnestly, your kingdom come, because it's the only solution. Our political parties, our economists, our universities, all imbued with the same lie that has distorted their thinking, do not have a solution, cannot provide a solution for the issues that we are facing, the problems that confront us. And he says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. In that mourning, we make progress in the path, in the ancient way that Christ has exemplified perfectly, abiding by those instructions that come from Genesis 1:1 to the last verse in chapter 22 of Revelation. Our lives are transformed. I mentioned epigenetics before. Our souls, our bodies are transformed by the changes in behavior that come from obeying those instructions, the commands and the commandments of God, the commands of Christ all through the Gospels. But that transformation then goes more as well, progresses into the mind and the spirit and the heart. And we mourn with that sense of loss that comes from someone who understands. And as our understanding keeps growing, that's what keeps happening. How are we comforted? We are comforted because in that growing understanding, we capture more and more the reality of both sides of the issue. Yes, the world is decaying, but yes, there is a plan. Yes, the world is breaking down, but yes, God has it in hand. He knows exactly what steps need to be taken, what events must transpire, and what he must do for that plan to be accomplished. And there is, of course, the comfort that comes from knowing no power in the universe can divert his plan, can confront God and be successful. And so the comfort grows in this life from that understanding, and it also grows as we consider further what will happen when, in fact, that kingdom is in place. And the relief that comes from envisioning what the world will be like when, in fact, people have appropriated these foundational teachings of Christ and they become part of their life. The transformation that will take place at all levels of society when the lie is not the prevalent thing that is established foundationally in their minds as little ones and impacts everything that grows in their neural networks after that. We are also comforted by the hope that comes in prayer and understanding that this contact we have with the creator of the universe leads to a reverence for the kind of power that he has, for his holiness, for his mercy, for his ability to judge rightly, and for his willingness to forgive. We are comforted every time we realize I messed up again, different area perhaps, and I know that the Father will forgive me and I will not have to collect the penalty that comes associated with that breaking of the law. That is tremendous comfort, because out there you do something wrong and often you don't have much of a chance. You know, you get nipped in the bud and you lose your job, you are arrested. I mean, all kinds of crazy things happen out there when you don't go along with what the establishment has in place, regardless of the country. It may be here, maybe not as much, but in some places it's just, the government is just plumb out horrible. So we're comforted from this, and the question now is, who mourns? Who is the individual that is obeying God in such a way that these characteristics of Christ's character start growing in him and he becomes a peacemaker? Or he becomes poor in spirit, or in this case, as these characteristics of Christ's character grow in him, he becomes someone who mourns personally and systemically for what's going on in the world. Who is that individual? That individual is someone who's been transformed by thought and action, by abiding by the instructions of Christ. Paul tells us, let this mind be in you, who was in Christ Jesus. If his mind, in fact, starts abiding more and more in us, our behavior is transformed, and we come to the point where we, you know, Christ wept considering what was coming to Jerusalem. And we can weep just like he does. We are transformed as we follow Christ, live his example and commands, and that transformation becomes universal in terms of our being. Not only that, because we are being transformed, then other things fall in place, like being a light to the world. It happens because of the transformation, because people can see we are different. If we are true disciples, these foundational principles will take place in us and take root and blossom as we go through this process of obedience to these commands. So, what are the requirements? What are the elements? And there are quite a few that can't be covered all in one area, but I do hope again in the future to dedicate a simple message to each one of them, because I believe they really require that much attention. The first item that I believe comes to mind is responsibility. God is responsible. Christ is responsible for everything that he placed in the creation. One of the reasons he came to be sacrificed is because he was responsible. One of the things that, you know, I spoke about it sometime in the past in terms of something that we read that sometimes, it puzzled me for quite a while until I dedicated some time to really study it. Matthew 5:23, where we read, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. We do this because something happened of which we have some responsibility. The word, ophelo, from the Greek, It means that we are going to proceed to do the good that would be due to another individual. This is what is expected here. You remember that your brother has something against you. If you are responsible, if you exercise this characteristic, if it's growing in you, you go and do the good that is due to that brother. And that's what he is demanding here. Basically, just leave the gift, go, first be reconciled. That is your responsibility. That's what you must do. It's a command. It's something that produces other duties. We can go to Romans 13. And these duties, again, once executed, keep the process of transformation in us. Romans 13, verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love one another. Again, if you are responsible, you're going to do the good that is owed to another person. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law, has executed responsibility to the extent that the law allows or requires. In chapter 15, and verse 1, we then, who are strong, ought to bear with the scruples or the weaknesses, the idiosyncrasies of the weak, and not to please ourselves. Again, because we are aware of the concept of responsibility, of this characteristic that we need to develop in us, we address the needs of these other brothers and sisters who may be weak in some aspect, and we give them what it's owed to them because it's our responsibility to provide it if we are the ones who are strong. Additionally, in Ephesians 5 and verse 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Ophelo, ought to. It is something that we owe to the wife, that being responsible is something we're going to execute. Love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. There's always a benefit to obeying God. You love your wife, you are automatically loving yourself because she's an integral part of who you are. And sometimes it's challenging because of any number of notions that are flying out there that we may subscribe to, at least in part, or that impact our thinking. But it's something that we must do. Another element that I believe is required to formulate this, to take on this particular capacity to mourn, is thoroughness. Thoroughness is the awareness that God watches, that we have been given a task, no matter how big and complex, no matter how menial and simple, but that he is going to inspect everything that we do. And so with that awareness, we are to execute everything in a thorough manner. That is, God is going to inspect this, he's going to be happy, he's not going to be happy with a once over and it kind of stayed that way. It's good enough for the government, as some say. It's good enough for the government, it's good enough for me. No, it's not good enough for the government. God expects thoroughness. As we look in his creation, Paul tells us to look at the creation because it instructs us on God's way of thinking. As we look at the creation, we look, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with an amoeba, a unicellular algae, a mosquito, an ant, a human being, a cypress tree, or a sequoia. We see thoroughness executed to what we would call an extreme level, something that we're not quite capable of doing. But we are supposed to be learning to do things that way. So whether I'm washing a plate, or sowing carrots, or typing an email to send to a manager at work, thoroughness is expected. Because ultimately we don't do work for him, do we? Let's see, Matthew 26. We have to operate in the way that will give us some reassurance that God is watching and that he will be pleased. That's why thoroughness is executed. We don't want him to be displeased. Matthew 26 and verse 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to his disciples and said, take and eat. This is my body. Verse 27, then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you. 28, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. 30 years of preparation, 3.5 years of execution of the plan, it all comes down to this. He had been thorough in everything, executed the plan perfectly in all its details, and then we are asked to take care of ourselves and the heart in that way. Let's go to Psalms 26. And we start examining something that God puts out there for us to pay attention to. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart. When God examines me, will he see thoroughness of attention and focus in what he commands me to do? Thoroughness of execution? Try my mind and my heart. And he will try. Just like things are tried in a laboratory. He will try. He will examine and he will try to put us in the spot where we can continue to make progress in that path, coming to understand this. Further, in Psalm 51:2, the prayer of repentance from King David, 51, verse 2, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. In a multiplying way, go through all the layers, clean everything up, don't leave any root. Christ talks about leavening, and those spores are very, very small. Don't leave anything, not even a spore. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. This is the thoroughness that King David was asking God to use in dealing with his situation, in helping him become the man that God wanted him to become. And it's the same thoroughness that we are expected to exercise when we, on the other hand, are preparing. The word rabba from the Greek means to multiply, to go through these multiple processes to execute everything. It's not enough to just wash the car. I really need to clean the wheels and oil the tires and make this car look as if it had come off the lot. That's what the thorough job. If God had given me that car and told me, clean it up for me, what would I do? Leave the tires dirty? Just polish the top, put some wax? No, we would be going into extremes to make sure that everything had been properly cleaned up. And here, basically, King David is saying, clean me in that way. Don't leave even a spore in me of this thing that conquered me and made me offend you, that made me go against you. As he says here, against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight. And I can only imagine to some degree how heartbroken King David must have been. So he expresses it well. This is the thoroughness that we are to deal with. In the New Testament, of course, in Colossians we find some of this expression. Colossians 3 and verse 22 through 24, bondservants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not to men. And again, if we were executing anything, any specific command that God gave us on everyday life, as opposed to some of the things that we see in the scriptures, just any little thing that you told us to do, wouldn't we do it to the extent that we're able, in the best way that we could? Maybe even ask somebody else, help me out here. I'm not really sure if I've done this completely. I know that you've done this work before. That's what you do all the time. To me, it's a new thing. Am I missing something? Do I need to go further? Is there something else that I need to examine, do, execute, etc.? That's what we would do under that kind of situation. Well, he's always watching. It's an illusion to think that we're only working at the office or only working in the garden for ourselves or whatever it is that we do. It is an illusion. And what's expected is that, in fact, we'll be thorough. In other words, we're going to execute whatever task it is. in such a way that we know God is coming to inspect it and hopefully will approve of the way that we did it. Thoroughness is going to that level. The next thing that is important, of course, in coming to the point where you can mourn and examine yourself about what you see and what the consequences are, is sincerity. Sincerity slash integrity. Now, sincerity comes from the Latin, sincerus, generally two roots, sine, sera, meaning without wax. In Roman manufacturing facilities, people would make pots of clay, and the high-grade clay doesn't have pebbles in it. It's a very smooth, I've worked with clay, and I can tell good clay versus not so good clay. Very smooth, and you can make this pot and sell it, and it's a good pot. But those people who were producing pots with inferior clay, with little pebbles in it and everything, once you bake this thing, you know, you see that the pebbles separate a little bit from the rest of the mass, and now you have these little pokes all over the surface. So what these artisans would do is they'll cover the holes with wax, and then they would paint it over. And so you couldn't tell what the quality was for the wax until that pot had to be used for cooking or was under the heat, and the wax melted, and they realized, I have a defective pot. So the good artisans with good clay would print in the bottom of the pot, sine sera, without wax. And that's where sincerity comes from. You're transparent. Everybody sees exactly what you are. There's no discrepancy between the inner life and what people see in you. To be sincere, to have integrity, to be transparent. First John, let's go to First John. No, I'm sorry. Let's go for Matthew 5 first, because that's the execution of something that could produce this in us. Matthew 5. Still continuing from that set of instructions with which he started. I know Matthew 5 was here this morning. There we go, Matthew 5, 46. For if you love those who love you. So we're talking about the fact that God does not discriminate, that he takes care of every human being because ultimately all have the potential to be in his family. And so he treats everybody in a fair way. So if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors, these despised people in our society, don't they do the same thing as you're doing? What's the great thing you're doing if you love those who love you? And if you greet your brethren only, if the Samaritan and the Roman and the Cypriot that shows up in your city is treated like scum, what is it that you are accomplishing? You know, you're not really doing anything that great. The tax collectors do the same thing. They treat their friends well. Therefore, you shall be perfect in executing these things he talked about before. You shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. By abiding by this set of practices of looking at people in a different way, with integrity and with sincerity, addressing their concerns, working with them, no matter what point in life and their development and their path in the way or out of the way they find themselves, by treating everyone in a proper manner, by loving, as he mentioned, your enemies as a command, then we go beyond what the tax collectors were willing and or able to do. As disciples of Christ, that's something we need to do. 1 John 3:3. 1 John 3:3. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. Everyone who has this hope in him goes through this clay that we are and takes out these little pebbles that do not belong in the texture of good quality clay. You take out the little pebbles so that when the vase is being formed by your actions under God's instructions and empowered by his Spirit and directed by Christ's mind, you become less and less burdened with these pebbles that are not really part of your nature, that need to be expelled. and you become more and more pure in that sense. You purify just as he is pure, because there was nothing in Christ that was not pure. He's still our example. He's still our benchmark. He's still the yardstick, if you will, by which we are measured. And as we thoroughly measure ourselves by that yardstick, by his instructions, by the commands he gave us, we can execute the mission that he has given the entire church. We ought to go throughout the world and teach them to obey all things he commanded. Because that's how he lived. Because that's how we must live if we are to become like him. That is how we must live if we are going to come to the point where we mourn in the right way and can have the hope of comfort at the right time. These characteristics, responsibility, thoroughness in execution, and sincerity create a certain sensitivity in us, a certain openness that allows us to see what's going on, not only in ourselves but the world around us, in a new light, in a far greater depth than anybody out there can really see. And we can mourn. Our heart can be burdened because we see the tragedy of living life that way, in our own personal mistakes, but also in what we see going on out there. Mourning among Christ's disciples starts with this internal evaluation that makes us realize where we are when compared to the only pattern we have to compare ourselves with, which is Jesus Christ. And we then execute the correction that expands into the transformation that he expects of us, that he looks forward to seeing in us. And at the same time, we depart from the ills and the way of thinking and the practices that this world dishes out, both in this nation and in the world at large. It is good and well to mourn and to change, and as we mourn, as we are afflicted, to look forward to the reward that he has for us. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted.